Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 109, I chat with Steve Guttenberg about the value of audio measurements. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 30th, 2012. Episode 109, Accuracy Schmaccuracy. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, online editor of hometheater.com. This week's guest geek is Steve Guttenberg, a contributor to Home Theater and to Stereophile and to innerfidelity.com, three of our websites, as well as the author of his own blog, The Audiophiliac at CNET. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Just came back from a weekend substitute hosting for Leo on his radio show, so I'm back in the saddle here in L.A. and ready to talk with you about the most a most interesting subject, which you approached me about, and I said, yeah, let's talk about that, which is the relevance and importance of objective measurements as opposed to subjective listener and reviewer experience. We're going to get into that, and it's a very interesting subject, a lot of strong opinions on either side. So I want to make sure that those of you who are logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv or watching live at live.twit.tv can post questions regarding this topic for Steve and me, and we will... I will shoot them out to Steve, and we'll get as many of them discussed as we can. I don't think there's any firm answer to this question, but we'll certainly have fun batting it about a bit.
Yeah, let's start batting away. So, because, you know, I really wanted to call this piece Accuracy Schmaccuracy.
And I think that's what I'm going to end up calling it, yes.
Okay, good. Let's go for that. You know, in a way, there was a cover of a Stereophile about 10, 15 years ago, and it was a big headline, and it said, it was a picture of a single-ended tube amplifier and a big solid-state amplifier. And the headline was, if one of these is right, the other one must be wrong. And the idea, you know, that is it merely the better-sounding amplifier, in this case, is automatically the better amplifier? Well, it's, you could say objectively it's the better amplifier because it measures in every way better, that the solid state measures objectively better than the tube amplifier.
Right.
But in the high-end world, tube amps, tube electronics in general, are hugely popular. Their popularity hasn't dissipated over the years. If anything, it goes up every year. If you go to any high-end show, I would say way more than half of the rooms will have tube amplifiers. So clearly, the objective best measuring ones are not always the ones that people actually prefer. And that's pretty much my point.
And this is the crux of the argument is when you take objective measurements, you will find certain results, pardon me, and see numbers and squiggly lines, as you've said. and yet then when you listen to them, you might have a completely different experience. So in your opinion, Does objective measurement have any place in an audio review?
You know what? In the after effects of doing this story with Tile, I would say I've retreated slightly in my position in that I think the main purpose of objective measurements are to uncover any really grievous aspects of a design that for some reason or another eluded the reviewer's ears. But basically, my view is that the measurements are basically there to just make sure that nothing is really horribly wrong. But, you know, I also want to say right up front that it's not that I'm opposed to measurements in general. And I think that engineers designing products should use measurements to know where they're going within the context of a design. My beef, so to speak, is that can consumers look at a wiggly line in a magazine or on a website and say that amplifier A or headphone A is better than headphone B or amplifier B? That's I have problems with.
And I should mention, you mentioned the conversation you had with Tile Hertzens, the editor of innerfidelity.com, our website that deals mostly with headphones and personal audio. And there's an article on that site, which is basically a conversation between you two about this very subject. So I would definitely recommend that people go check that out as well.
Yeah. And I just want to say something. You know, I've had this, my blog, The Audiophiliac, for 5 years. And it's a lot of fun to do a blog because you get instant feedback from the readers, which when you write for print magazines, you don't have that.
That's
so it's
for sure.
Great to see the response. But I think that it's kind of frustrating that the people who responded, and it got a lot of good comments, is that they don't really address that question that I just referred to. Because the people on the accuracy side, on the measurement side, are basically stuck in that position and are basically, in all their criticisms of my point of view, didn't address what I started out at the beginning of this, that a lot of people prefer tube amplifiers over solid-state amplifiers. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that LPs, analog, sounds better than digital, even though digital clearly measures better. And they didn't really address that. They said that they needed those measurements, that the measurements were basically an objective way of looking at the performance of a given product, and they wanted the one that is most accurate, which is perfectly valid, except there's one little problem with that, wanting the most objective, most accurate product, is that the music that people are listening to, assuming we're talking about audio, isn't made that way. It's made with all sorts of inaccuracies. People don't use measurement microphones to record vocals or to record the sound of a piano or a drum. They use intentionally colored microphones to get the sound that they want.
So and in fact, many recording engineers, if I talk to them, I'll say, or people in the chat room will ask, what's your favorite microphone? Because as you say, they all have a different character.
Right. And then, course, the follow-up to that statement would usually be, but I want to hear exactly what they heard, what the engineer, what the mixing engineers were trying to do. Again, that's a perfectly valid, desire. It's just getting there is really difficult. With speakers, how a speaker measures in an anechoic environment has nothing to do with the way it's going to sound in your room. So,
and this brings up. This brings up a really interesting point as well, which is speaker measurements will tell you something, but they usually have to be done in an anechoic environment, as you say, which is to take the room out of the equation, per se. Mm-hmm. But the reviewer and the buyer, the purchaser, the consumer of these speakers are going to put them in a room, and that room will be very different from one person to the next. Mm-hmm. And the room really has to be considered as one component in the entire audio system because it has such a strong influence on what you end up hearing.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that the video guys have a completely different thing. When you calibrate a TV, and you watch that TV or a display or projection system in a dark room, no matter where you are, no matter how big or small your room is, it's pretty much going to look exactly the same, no matter what. If it's a good TV and it's calibrated, it's always going to look exactly the same. In your room, in my room, in Madison Square Garden, wherever it is, it's exactly the same image.
But as long as it's a dark room
and doesn't have reflections, okay. But
right, and but doesn't it, have white it, walls, yeah,
and doesn't have white walls. But with speakers or even with headphones to a lesser degree, there's no guarantee. Well, there's no way that the speaker's always going to sound the same, or even the headphones are going to sound. Your ear shape is different with in-ear headphones. Your ear canal is of different lengths and different diameters. So all bets are off when it comes to listening to speakers or headphones. It's less of a problem, obviously, with headphones, but it's still significant.
Yeah. So, Steve, clearly the room has a lot to do with what you hear when you listen to a speaker, less so on headphones. But everybody's ears are different, of course, so there is quite a bit of variability there. Much less so with video. I think we were talking about how if you calibrate a TV in a, and watch it in a dark room, we have a very specific set of standards to do that, and it's going to look the same from one room to another as long as you have a dark room without reflective walls.
Right.
What about, are there any sort of similar standards for audio? I mean, that would be one question to ask.
I wish there were, you know. I mean, you know, so obviously I'm coming from a very subjective point of view. And yeah. I think it's amazing when you think about it that even when you apply hard science to the science of acoustics, that there haven't been really too many great sounding halls created in the last, let's say, 20 or 30 years. That the old halls like Carnegie Hall are still considered fantastic sounding places to hear music, and they were built before there was such a thing as a microphone or anyone could measure sound.
Right.
And it's interesting that with all the technology that's come in that 100 years since then, that no one's actually made better sounding halls. They're more flexible and they can do different things, but no one's said, "Oh, we got to rebuild Carnegie Hall because it sounds old fashioned. It's just not as good as a contemporary hall." That just doesn't really happen.
The Concertgebouw in Amsterdam is another another great example.
Right.
The only recent example I can think of is Disney Hall here in LA, which I've been to many times. And for orchestra concerts, it's fabulous. And they must have done some more modern kinds of analysis to determine. But there, for example, there are no square corners. There are no straight lines anywhere in that hall.
That's a little bit beside
the point.
We got off the subject, but I mean, the thing is, so you can look at a calibrated TV, a good quality TV, and it's going to look the same no matter what, as long as the room is dark, right? But with speakers, and to a lesser degree with headphones, there's no guarantees. And again, not to pick on it, but those little wiggly lines that discern a great sounding headphone or speaker from a not so good one, they're just a matter of degree of how wiggly they are. You know,
right?
Compared to a straight line of frequency response or impulse tests or however way you want to measure a headphone. So those lines have to be interpreted subjectively by the person who's running the tests.
True enough.
Go ahead. It's interesting that when Tyler and I had this debate, he mentioned that the Sennheiser HD800 is the best measuring headphone he's ever tested. Unfortunately, he doesn't particularly like the sound of that headphone. And on the opposite side, he mentioned that the B&W P5 is not a particularly good measuring headphone, and yet he enjoys its sound. So the point of my diatribe is trying to correlate measurements with predictions of sound quality are very difficult to do. And most important, even if you could do it repeatedly, how that applies to the listeners and to the people who are potentially buying the headphones or the speakers is, again, a crapshoot. So it's tough.
The whole concept of standards makes me want to ask about, there is a standard, I guess, in audio in that what you put in is what you get out, or in other words, a flat frequency response. Isn't that something we should shoot for?
Theoretically, ideally, they never really look all that flat.
No, they never do. It's true.
And even if you made them flat in the anechoic chamber, once you put them in the room with reflections and different distances from walls, then all bets are off.
Yeah. Luis in the chat room is asking about double blind testing. And I know you've got some thoughts on that.
I do. it's almost like, well, let me put you this way. Even if you measured something, if you did a double blind test with things that measure quite differently, do you expect that the people who are doing the listening would be able to identify them? And the answer is, depends on the kind of difference between the two things. It would take a fairly gross difference before it would become repeatable that in A-B tests, listener could identify A from B. So in that case, it's not when we're talking about things that are close. We're talking about things that are even purposely different. It would be hard to come up with it. So if you really believe in blind tests, well, your job as a consumer is pretty easy because you can buy pretty much any piece of crap and you'll be perfectly happy, because in a blind test, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between that and something better.
Mm.
So great. You've saved a ton of money and you can get whatever you want, not worry about it.
I think so. Cal Ray Jr. in the chat room mentioned something about Harman doing a bunch of double blind tests, and they found that the reference quality product was not always the one that was generally preferred.
Hmm. And the reference one is presumably the better measuring one.
Right. Precisely. Exactly right.
Exactly, you know, I got to tell you, one of the reasons that I started obsessing about this is about last year, I went to a demo in a hotel room of a Danish company who was demonstrating a new type of room correction system. And I went to this thing and I sat in a room with engineers, and they had a laptop on a coffee table, and they were showing me all these charts and graphs of before the measurement was applied and after the measurement applied and how much better it was going to be. And they talked for about an hour and I was getting kind of impatient. I said, can you just do the demo for me? And they had two systems set up. One was like a desktop system and one was a small home theater. So we did the desktop first, and with or without room correction or speaker correction, it sounded awful. Just different kinds of awful depending on with or without room correction. And when we did the home theater, it was better, and clearly the room correction helped, but it still didn't sound particularly good. In neither situation did it really help. And I came away from this experience thinking that the people, these engineers who are very intent and very good people and were highly motivated to make better measuring systems, had sort of missed the point of it all, is that the sound was still awful. So again, that's one of the reasons why I am biased in the direction of I like to deal with people, engineers and designers, who know what good sound sounds like as opposed to what good sound measures like. Because I've been exposed to people who make good measuring equipment, speakers and audio, it's not usually the stuff that lasts. And that's just not in my opinion. It doesn't actually have a long shelf life in terms of, oh, we designed this 20 years ago and it measures great then and it measures great now, and it's a product that people care about. That tends not to happen. You know, the LP12 turntable came out in 1972. And you could have a 1972 Lin with a great arm and cartridge, and it would still sound good. That doesn't apply to a lot of other things that presumably measured better.
Again,
not just my opinion. People still buy Lins. Matter of fact, you try to buy a used Lin on eBay, they still go for a lot of money.
Well, this is an interesting point, too, that people look for, and it's kind of off topic, but I'll just mention it anyway. People often look for older audio equipment, but they don't look for older video equipment.
Isn't that amazing? And you know, here's an interesting thing. Scott, do you remember what the price of early plasma TVs was?
All too
like
well.
In the late 90s, I guess.
Yeah, 42-incher was like 10 grand.
Yeah, but some of them were more like 15 grand, right?
Yeah. They easily went up to that level.
Right. Nobody's going around collecting them. And people who had money and wanted to get a new flat screen TV because it was new technology, presumably they had enough money. And if they still have money, virtually no one who bought a TV in 1999, it would still use it today. They might put it in their kids' room or something, but it would hardly be a reference quality TV. Time has marched on. But if someone had bought a $12,000 hi-fi system in 1999, it would still be a really good system.
Yes.
So exactly. In terms of value and something that lasts, audio is always well ahead. It's a more settled technology, but it lasts. People have 50-year-old electronics. My friend David Chesky uses quad electrostatic speakers. His particular set were made in 1959, I think.
Wow.
And he is an exacting audiophile, and that system sounds amazing because it was a great speaker, probably not designed with measurements either, by the way. Mm-hmm. and it's still a great speaker and of true reference quality, because the guy who designed it had ears and knew what good sound sounded like.
Right. Well, knowing what good sound sounds like is a point I wanted to get back to in terms of double blind testing.
Okay.
Which is that one thing that I think is important in double blind testing. You were mentioning something about how most people wouldn't be able to really hear much of a difference unless there was a gross difference. And, well, and I think that's probably true. But with if you have listeners who are experienced listeners who know what good sound is supposed to sound like, who have spent a lot of time like you have, like I have, like Michael Fremer has and John Atkinson and all of the Stereophile crew and Tyle Hertzens for that matter, you know, you've spent a lot of time listening critically and know are able to recognize more subtle differences than the general consuming public, perhaps makes a double blind testing more valid and valuable.
Perhaps.
Thank you for that pithy and succinct answer.
Beat this horse too much.
I understand. Well, a lot of people in the chat room are saying, oh no, double blind testing, that's the way to go. That's the only way to really, you know.
I agree. I agree.
There are a lot of people who believe in it.
If that's your belief system, then you should only listen to reviewers who would submit to double blind tests. And I think that's what they should do. If that's their standard, if that's the way they want to approach it, then I can't argue with that. That's valid. Mm-hmm. But I just want to bring up one other thing. You know, most audiophiles are aware that in Canada, they have this research facility that the Canadian government built for private enterprise. It's called the NRC, the National Research Council, right? And a lot of Canadian speaker companies use those facilities. PSB speakers.
Being one of them,
famous for that, right? Well, there's another Canadian company that I'm not going to mention by name, and they also use the NRC. And I remember reviewing one of their speakers, a home theater speaker system, and I got these speakers and I set it up, and the center channel speaker was one of the worst sounding speakers I'd ever heard in my life. It was truly exceptional in being bad. It was an awful sounding, very nasal, very sounding center speaker. Right. Right. And I thought, this is really curious that here is this company that does blind testing, because that's part of what happens at the NRC, who made a speaker that sounded like that. And yet, they didn't notice how bad it was. I thought that was very, very strange. And again, not just my opinion, because I can have my opinions. I'm a subjective reviewer. But you know what's interesting? That speaker did not stay in the line very long. It was discontinued a few months after I made that observation. So the seat, you see, if a seat of the pants by his ear kind of engineer made a bad sounding speaker, you go, well, he has bad judgment. He had a bad day. He had a bad 6 months when he was designing that speaker, and he made a lousy sounding speaker. I would say that would be more excusable than a company that presumably uses science and hard measurements to make a speaker that objectively measures well and passes blind tests and then sucks. How does that happen?
How does that happen?
Well, because everything has to be interpreted. I think that's the only explanation of why companies that use science and hard measurements to determine their products. In this debate with Tyle, you know, I said it's interesting that John Grado in Brooklyn, I interviewed him last year.
Who makes Grado headphones, by the way.
Makes Grado headphones and phono cartridges. He told me that he never measures anything he designs. And I thought, that's really interesting. He says, I've been doing it so long, I don't need to measure them. And I said, but here's the interesting thing, Tyle, that you take a company like Sennheiser, and they're German, they measure everything, they're a very science-oriented company. I said, so here's a strange thing. Why is it that Grado headphones from one model to the next sound very consistent? They have a Grado sound. And yet Sennheiser, the by-the-book science company, their headphones are all over the place. There's very little consistency to the sound of Sennheiser headphones. I guess because someone is making subjective opinions about the sounds of those products. They're just not fessing up to that fact. What else is the explanation?
I can't imagine what it
might be.
It's very odd. It's very odd. Tommy Tom Tom in the chat room, going back to the old the old video versus old audio product saying, all my TVs are still CRTs. and I must say that there is that, you know, there is a market for specific, particular CRT TVs from Sony.
Oh, Philco's. Of course, yeah.
I don't know about Philco's, but Sony's, I think it's the XBR 960, one of their last CRT TVs, high definition. And certainly CRTs, I mean, all flat panel technologies are still trying to achieve the black level of CRT. And we think OLED will do it finally, but plasma doesn't really do it. Kuro came close, Pioneer, before they went under. And LED illuminated LCDs can sort of do it, but kind of only sort of. So there's one example of video technology that might be worth going back to. But the thing's 500 pounds, and it weighs, you know, it's three feet on a side, a gigantic thing. And
you have to suffer for your art.
You have to suffer for your art, exactly. Go ahead.
I was going to change the subject slightly in my curmudgeonly rant here.
Yes, go right
ahead. I noticed, I was looking at the home theater website the other day, and I was looking at a review of an Onkyo receiver, the, I think it was NR009. And the reviewer said that when he was setting it up to do the review, that he was having some problem with the video connections on the receiver. And then I guess he talked to somebody from the company, and they said that he had to get a new firmware update. And in order to do this firmware update, you have to have, for some reason, all of the connections disconnected from the receiver. It took three attempts to finally get this thing to actually work. And I thought, it's so interesting that computers have made people, the marketplace, very tolerant of buying unfinished products.
Hasn't that often been the case, though? That I mean, there's a commercial on TV these days about smartphones, all smartphone buyers being beta testers.
Right. It's like if you went to a restaurant and they said, you know, our dishwasher didn't show up today. Would you mind spending a little time in the kitchen before we serve your meal? Just help us out a little bit. Because you have to work. This guy put in 3 or 4 hours of work to make this product perform as it should have out of the box. It's nice. That's to get to do the company's work for them.
Yes. Well, but we don't see that with speakers, certainly, or headphones. Right. I guess audio electronics, possibly.
With home theater, unfortunately, related products.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, listen, before we go on, I do want to thank a moment. Let's do an edit there, shall we, John? 3, 2. Hey, before we go on, I do want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, Netflix. Netflix offers thousands of TV episodes and movies streamed instantly to your TV, PC, game console, Blu-ray player, now AV receivers, as if they didn't do everything already. Now they also are starting to stream Netflix directly into your home instantly, while saving you time, money, and hassle. You don't have to worry about getting discs in the mail and sending them back or anything like that. It's all very, very straightforward. And the quality continues to improve. I've been watching Netflix now for several months. And for things that you can't get any other way, it's just priceless to me. And even better, it doesn't cost very much. So one low monthly fee and you can stream thousands of titles directly into your home using just about any device, as I said before. You can even start on one device and finish on another, so making it very convenient for whatever your lifestyle happens to be. Now, for Twit listeners, Netflix is offering a 30-day free trial. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit. Be sure to use that URL, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the Twit Network. So let's see. I got a bunch of questions in the chat room. Let me see if I can pull up a couple of them here. Beatmaster had a good point. In regards to good sound, isn't the era and music you grew up with a cause for, doesn't that apply some bias to one's preferences?
Preferences?
I'm sorry?
We all have preferences, of course.
We
it would depend, sure, on your sort of music. If you listen to classical music, you would wind. Remember, that used to be a thing with having rock speakers and classical speakers, and
right,
then people
said,
"Oh, that shouldn't be. They should all be perfect." It sounds like a nice idea, but in fact, a rock speaker is a different kind of speaker than a speaker that would sound good with classical music. And if you want one that does both, if you want to listen to string quartets and Metallica, sure, you can do it, but you're not, unless you spend a lot of money, you're not going to get a speaker that does both really well.
Then there's
the issue.
It's a fantasy
that you should.
Yeah. Then there's the issue that I get asked about all the time, which is speakers for music listening and speakers for home theater listening.
Right. Well, I did a piece on that for Home Theater Magazine last year.
Well, that's true, and it's now on hometheater.com, so you can find that.
And it was about optimizing when you're buying a theater, home theater speaker system, audio system. Which way are you going to go? Are you going to be listening a lot more to music than movies, or the other way around? Because just to distill it down to the essence, if you're mostly going to listen to music on your system, you should invest the lion's share, well over 50% of the speaker budget, into the left and right speakers.
Right.
And if you're mostly going to watch movies, you should put, I wouldn't say half, but a significant portion into the center speaker, then into the left and rights, and then into the surrounds. You know, if you have a big enough budget, you could get, of course, great speakers all around. But if you're going to have to make compromises for home theater, you should have a really good center channel speaker. That's like 80% of the soundtrack of a movie is in the center channel. It's certainly the most important part. So, and of course, good subwoofer. I mean, everything is important. It's just how you distribute your funds is the question.
Right. Exactly right. I wanted to point out, we were talking earlier about looking for old audio gear and people really still finding great value in it. You've just started a new blog in Home Theater Magazine.
Right.
A column in Home Theater Magazine and a blog on hometheater.com called Vintage Gear, in which you actually call out and identify some of these classic pieces of audio gear that people still look for.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I did one recently on the AR3, the Acoustic Research, the third speaker in their line. And it was an amazing story that Edgar Vilcher basically invented acoustic suspension speakers, basically sealed box speakers. And he didn't want to start a speaker company. He wanted to basically licensed this idea to other speaker companies. And when he did demos for other companies of the time, this is the early 50s, basically no one believed that it actually worked, even though he had a working prototype to demonstrate it for him. And they all just sort of said, nah, we're not really interested. So he started Acoustic Research basically because he couldn't get anybody else to do it. And then Acoustic Research in the 50s and in the early 60s had something like a third of the entire American speaker market. That's just staggering. It was gigantic.
Wow.
And they were relatively expensive speakers for their time.
Uh-huh.
So this speaker that I focused on, the AR3, was the first speaker to have a dome tweeter and actually also a dome mid-range. It sold for, I believe, $219 in 1959. And good units that still exist now sell for over $3,000 on eBay.
Wow.
But I also did one recently on the LP12 turntable that we talked about. I did one on the Pioneer Kuru displays. And that was an amazing story.
Oh, you mean the Kuro plasmas?
Yeah.
Oh. So there is one. And there's another example of a piece of video equipment. It's not that old. It's only they only stopped in 2009, I think.
Right.
Boy, if you can find one of those online, that's certainly worth getting.
But isn't that interesting with the Pioneer, though, that a Pioneer had to withdraw from the market because their TVs were too expensive because they wanted to make a TV that was substantially better than their competitions at that time, and it had to be more expensive. They could not be price competitive to make something better, and yet the market wouldn't support it. That's really interesting.
I find that fascinating, absolutely. Web4078 in the chat room is asking, what's the most important characteristic that makes that has the most effect of, on the quality of an audio system? It's a pretty big question.
Well, there's two ways to answer that question. One would be the speakers, that the better quality speakers will always give you better sound. But, you know, being an old person like myself, there used to be a thing that Lynn started called the hierarchy of the system, meaning that the source of the system, the turntable, is the most important part. Because if the information is lost by the turntable, having a great amplifier, a great speaker, it's not magically going to restore information that's not there. So
right.
It sort of depends on the kind of system. But I would say time has marched on. And since most people are using digital sources, with the difference between a good one and a not so good one is not as huge, that putting your money into the best possible speakers and setting them up properly would be the most important thing.
SoCal Ray Jr. asks, why do all pieces of audio gear seem to need 100 hours or so of break-in?
Ah.
And why do they never break in the wrong direction?
Well, Tile at Inner Fidelity has done a lot of work on measuring the effects of break-in on headphones. He's done a lot. He's continuing to do it, actually, where he took two pairs of AKG 701 headphones, and one he just keeps in the box, and one he's just putting hours and hours and hours on the second one, and then measuring them side by side and seeing what the differences are. And the differences
I was just going to say, here may be an application for measuring that might mean something.
Right. I mean, basically, I think what he's determined so far is that the measurements are not great, but someone, I can't remember who pointed out that one of the differences about headphones breaking in is that when you wear them, that the ear pads are getting broken into and creating a better seal. That they're
firm, molding sort of to your particular ears.
Right. And that kind of difference would be much more significant than how much the driver is breaking in. So it's complicated. It's always complicated.
Everything's always complicated.
I would say that if you don't like the sound when it's got a few hours on it, it's not going to, I don't think you're going to change your mind with a few hundred hours on it. But people have pointed over the years that with speakers and headphones and even amplifiers, that part of the things that's happening in the break-in is that you're breaking in, that you're basically accommodating to the sound of this thing. So your brain is doing some adjustment. So that, whether there's any actual break-in, your brain is definitely processing that sound differently.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a recording engineer. He showed me this really interesting test one day. I sat in his studio. He said, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do before I do it. I'm going to play this really nasty sounding, kind of like pink noise thing. And then I'm going to play the same thing like 10 or 20 dB louder. And then I'm going to play the initial one at this initial level. And I want you to tell me what you hear. So it was really interesting that when he played these three things, even though the first one and the third one were exactly the same, when he did it the third time, the third part sounded more nasty sounding, harsher, grittier than it did when I first heard it. And he said, that's because your ear accommodated to the second one. And then when you heard the third one, it was still processing for the second one.
Huh.
And that actually was one of the reasons why one of the reasons I was telling you about this is that's one of the problems with doing A-B blind tests is that when you go from A to B, your brain is still processing for A when you get to B. So it's not really hearing B objectively.
Right. That actually makes that makes great sense because as you go from one to the other, your ears and your brain have been biased in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Control Freak in the chat room is asking, do you know of the Carver, quote, amazing loudspeakers?
I do.
And what do you think?
I think the thing about Carver amazing speakers is that they were extremely inefficient. You need lots and lots of power, 300 watts easily to drive them, to make them sound good. The thing that was funny about that speaker, it's basically a two-way speaker, as I recall, with a ribbon tweeter, but the woofers were conventional cone woofers in an open baffle, so there was no box around the woofers. And the suspension of the woofers was intentionally very floppy. They were just going to flop around.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a good friend that had them, and they really did sound quite good. And considering what they were, and they were reasonably priced at the time, this is probably, I'm saying 20 years ago, I liked them a lot. But I think MagnaPan speakers, which are also flat panel speakers, are much better speakers overall.
Mm.
And they're still in business, and they still make them in the United States. And MagnaPan started around $600 for a 4-foot-tall floor-standing speaker with a ribbon tweeter. That's amazing that they can do that in the United States, an entirely American-made speaker.
Yeah.
And it's a great-sounding speaker.
There you go. Virgil in the chat room asks, how can the Grado 60 sound as good as the more expensive models? I think you may have already answered that in terms of Mr. Grado himself.
Right. There's a consistent... I mean, Tile's response to that question about the Grado was that he said that that's because the differences between one model of Grado and the next model of Grado aren't so huge. It's basically tweaking the recipe as you're going up the line. And Sennheiser's building completely different headphones.
Right.
But the 60 is a great sounding budget headphone. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we go, I wanted to make sure to have a chance for you to talk a little bit about, you have a poll running on your blog, The Audiophiliac, at, I think the website is news.cnet.com/audiophiliac.
Simpler than that. It's simpler than that. It's just you go to cnet.com/audiophiliac.
Oh, very good. And you're running a poll. You want people to tell you what they think the best speakers, headphones, receivers, and so on are.
Right. I've had this blog now for almost 5 years, and I've been talking about all the stuff that I think sounds good. But I think it's time to let the readers tell me what they think sounds good. So I want people to respond to this. It's basically, I'm taking nominations, and then I'm going to do it as a poll later on. Tell me what you think the best-sounding headphones are. In-ear headphones, full-size headphones, Bluetooth headphones, any kind of headphone. And the same thing with speakers, cheap speakers, computer speakers, panels, whatever you want. Say what you like. Receivers, electronics, turntables, Blu-ray players, whatever it is. Just tell me what you think. And then I'm going to take all those responses and sort of distill them down a bit and make that into a poll and let them vote.
Go right ahead.
I just want to make sure that people can find it. And probably the easiest way to find it would be just search on Audiophiliac, which is audio, P-H-I-L-I-A-C, and then reader nominations. And that'll get you there to that particular blog.
Cool. And certainly this will be... a very interesting, particularly if you find certain speakers or other pieces of equipment that are extremely popular. A lot of people vote for them and say, yeah, those sound really good. They're my favorite ones. And then we go and look at the measurements and see if there's any correlation or not. I'll look forward to doing that.
Well, I'll tell you right now that the Grado 60 headphone is by far leading the poll for headphones. Hmm. And it's not a great measuring headphone.
Great measuring headphone. Well, we said earlier...
The guy that designed it doesn't measure anything ever. So take that.
Yeah, so take that, measurement guys, objectivists.
You know what it is? I think it's a hobby, and people should enjoy listening to music in any way they can. And there's lots of great, inexpensive equipment like those Grados, like those MagnaPan speakers, and there's high-end equipment. It comes in all flavors, and all this back and forth. You know, you're an idiot because you like analog, or you're an idiot because you like digital or tubes or something. It's just kind of silly. If people like what they like, that's cool. You know, that's it. I'm not trying to really convince anyone. All I'm trying to do is present, have people have an open mind about it. That's all.
Well, and that's certainly what I would promote as well. And I also agree with you completely that in the end, what the hobby is really about, or what I think it's about for me anyway, is listening to music, and in my case, watching movies, and not spending as much time as some people do on tweaking and measuring and, spending more time on performance characteristics and less time on simply enjoying the media that all of this electronics and all of these products are meant to bring us. As I said on the radio show over the weekend, really what I'm trying to do is promote modern day storytelling.
Mm.
And what's important is the story. And yes, I want to reproduce it as well as I can in my system. But once I get it to a certain level, I'm going to say, okay, great. Now I'm going to enjoy a story, and hopefully the equipment will disappear from my consciousness.
Right. That's the idea.
Exactly.
You know, the other thing I want to say about audiophiles is that word has sort of become, I guess, an elitist term. And I think that anybody who listens to music occasionally without reading or talking or frying eggs or doing other things, if you can just put music on and listen to it with your eyes closed, preferably,
mm-hmm. Yep.
You're an audiophile, no matter what you're listening on, because most people don't. Most people put music on and then do something else. And I think if you love Jack White or Miles Davis, they put a lot of work into making those recordings. And if you gave it your undivided attention, whatever kind of music you like, you might actually get a lot more out of it, regardless of the equipment that you listen to it on. It's paying attention is the first step. And
yes.
that's such a rare thing nowadays that people don't really listen to it. It's just on, and then they're doing something else. And they're missing out. The people that do that are missing out on a lot of what their favorite artists put into their music. Those are my final thoughts about that.
Okay, very good. Well, F-Loop in the chat room says that you deserve credit for trying to find great gear in every price category, and you seem to be the antithesis of the audiophile snob. So,
thank you. It's very nice.
I appreciate that as well.
I just did a rave review. I wouldn't say a very positive review of a $22 integrated stereo amplifier. It's called the
$22.
Yep, you can get it on from Parts Express. It's called the Lepai LEPAILP 2020 Plus. And it's a 20-watt per channel amplifier. It's in a nice metal chassis. It has bass and treble controls. And it's very, very decent. And I'm going to be reviewing that tomorrow with another Parts Express product, the Dayton B652 speakers, which are about $40 a pair. They have 6-inch woofers. It's a small bookshelf speaker. So for $62... you could have a really nice stereo. You hook up your phone or iPod to it, and that could be pretty nice. So,
well, I was going to ask you what speakers.
I try to cover all bases.
Yes, exactly. I was going to ask you what kind of speakers you would use with a 20-watt amplifier. They'd have to be mighty efficient in order to get any kind of volume out of them at all. On the other hand, you really in most cases you're only using the first watt or two of power anyway, right?
I already reviewed the speaker, the amplifier, and I know that I used it with a bunch of speakers. It was fun. I used actually PSB Alpha B speakers, which are small bookshelf speakers, and it sounded fine. It could play definitely loud enough. So It's a great deal. So there's no reason why anybody can't have a very nice sounding stereo at any price range. And I write about a very expensive products on my blog. I write about $22 amplifiers. It's the full range.
Right.
Because I want more people to be involved. I don't want people to just go and buy the Bose or the Sony or whatever big name brands. There's a lot of really good stuff out there at all price ranges.
Are you with me that Bose products, generally speaking, are not high on your list?
They're not high on my list. And my biggest gripe against Bose is that they're very expensive. I don't think they make a home theater in a box system, or they didn't used to make a home theater in a box system for less than like $2,000. That's insane.
Yeah, it is. The only Bose product I really like are their noise-canceling headphones.
Right, their headphones are their best products.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we've come to the end of a fascinating discussion. I want to thank you so much, Steve Guttenberg, for being my guest today and stirring up all sorts of interesting chatter in the chat room. And lots of debate.
If you can find. Can people contact me? If people want to contact me, they can email me at theaudiophiliac@hotmail.com.
Yes, please. And so I encourage you all to email Steve and let him know what you think about this or any other subject in the world of audiophilia. And you can also read his stuff on my website, hometheater.com, stereophile.com, innerfidelity.com, and his own blog at cnet.com/audiophiliac. Thanks so much, Steve. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. It was fun.
Good deal. As I said, my home, my online home is hometheater.com, and you can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Avner Rosen, the CEO and co-founder of Boxy. So we're going to be talking about video and audio streaming from Boxy's point of view anyway. And that should be quite interesting. I hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.